Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 60, the first installment for 2020. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. I hope you had a joyous festive season and are enjoying a peaceful start to the new year. For us Aussies, it's been an incredibly challenging couple of months. Bushfires continue to devastate our beautiful country, and my heart breaks for the people and wildlife who have lost their lives, and for the many individuals and families who've lost their homes and livelihoods. I acknowledge that this is a very difficult and emotional time for many of our Australian listeners, but please know that you're in my heart. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast and welcome patrons who joined the Talking Tudors family in December. A warm welcome to Jesse and Callan. I'm so grateful for your generosity. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. January's prize is a copy of The Falcon's Rise, a novel of Anne Boleyn by Natalia Richards. A huge thank you to the author for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome back Dr. Sean Cunningham to Talking Tudors to discuss Henry VIII's first Christmas. Dr. Cunningham is head of the Medieval Records team at the UK National Archives, where he's worked for 20 years, time only just to scratch the surface of the medieval and Tudor collections. His main interest is British history in the period from around 1450 to 1558. Sean has published many studies of politics, society and warfare, especially in the early Tudor period, including Henry VII and Prince Arthur, the Tudor king who never was. He's recently been involved in the Tudor Chamber Books project and is co-writing with James Ross a related book on the projection and reception of Tudor kingship, 1485 to 1529. He's a fellow of the Royal Historical Society and co-convener of the Late Medieval Seminar at London's Institute of Historical Research. My conversation with Sean straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales.
Thank you.
back to talking to you, to Sean. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Natalie.
It's lovely to have you back. Yes, thank you. Happy New Year to you too. Now, since we last spoke, which was, now I can say last year, June 2019, we've had lots of new listeners find the podcast, which is fabulous. So would you mind introducing yourself again and telling our listeners just a little bit about your background?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Sean Cunningham and I'm head of medieval records at the UK National Archives. My background is in early Tudor history, so I wrote a lot about Henry VII's reign, but I'm increasingly expanding that forwards and backwards to see how that reign sits in the middle of developments in how England was governed and how England related to other countries. So my interests range from sort of 1450 to 1550 at the minute. So next year I'm looking forward to the anniversary of the Field of Cloth of Gold, for example. There's quite a lot of good things coming up about that and some other projects that we've got on the go. So yes, it's a very productive area to be interested in at the minute.
Absolutely. And now in our last episode, and if anyone wants to tune into that, that was number 35 that we recorded last year back in June. We chatted about lots of things. We talked about Prince Arthur, which you've written about Prince Arthur and Henry VII and some really exciting Tudor research that you're involved in. But in today's episode, we're going to focus on Henry VIII's first Christmas as king. Now, when Henry came to the throne in April 1509, he was just a couple of months shy of his 18th birthday. And to be honest, a far cry from the kind of obese and infirm monarch that he'd later become. So I thought we could start by you maybe just painting a picture for us of this young Henry.
Yes, it's a very exciting time for England, I suppose. The country had been under a bit of a cloud with Henry VII's final years, where he was insecure and worried about Edmund de la Poole, the Earl of Suffolk, raising the flag of rebellion again and trying to set him up as a rival as King of England. So Henry, the young Prince Henry, was living under a kind of house arrest almost. He was very much the heir that had to be protected. Henry was worried about what would happen if he died prematurely. So this clampdown on the ability of people to challenge the crown really affected the mood of the country. So when Henry VII died, his death was kept secret for a couple of days to enable a kind of court coup to allow Empson and Dudley, the notorious ministers that had run the country for Henry VII in his ailing final years, to be arrested. And that allowed young Henry to be brought to the throne in the conditions that certainly the old councillors wanted to see. So we have this almost 18-year-old king, slightly at odds with the older men who had been around Henry VII all the way through from Bosworth. So some of those are still surviving, like Thomas Lovell and Thomas Howard, the Earl of Surrey, Richard Fox, Bishop of Winchester. These were the people who'd the architects of Henry VII's regime, really. But they kind of lost touch with the reins of power as Empson and Dudley had run things. So Prince Henry is straining at the bit, really, to become king in his own right. He's been given a bit of leeway when he was slightly earlier in his teenage years. He was living at Kennington, or had a kind of jousting club at Kennington, and was forming those friendships with young and slightly less well-connected courtiers, forming his own circle. So these people wanted to really cement their connection to the new young king, and that put a slightly different feel on the regime, with these old councillors of Henry VII still trying to run things, and young Prince Henry really wanting to be a king in his own right, looking at the legacy of Henry V, or the example of Edward III in conquering France and using war as a glorious way of cementing kingship and building power. So Henry VIII comes to the throne and needs to really find this balance between ruling in the way that his father had, which was mastering government and dealing with relationships through financial administration, I suppose. Not very glamorous, but quite effective. And Prince Henry is very much a man of court and relies on his personal connections with people and his interactions. So it's a much more social and a kind of glamorous kind of relationship he wants to forge. So his new regime sets off on this step of a young, vibrant king trying to throw off the shackles of an ailing, aged and infirm, sick father and try to relaunch the Kingdom of England, I suppose, in a new way that's reflecting what's going on around Europe at the time.
Sounds a little bit like out with the old and in with the new for Henry. So why was Christmas in particular and important in establishing Henry's power and the strength of his court at this time?
Well, it was always a very important time for the court because it allowed certainly allowed the king to show his largesse, to show his benevolence and his magnificence. And it also allowed other lords to be almost kings in their own country. So they would be expected to be hosts of their great houses and castles around the country, representing the king's power, but also cementing their own. So Christmas is a time when power is on display, and hospitality and open-handedness and good lordship, I suppose, is very much to the fore. So a lot of lords would throw open their gates and have large parties for hundreds of people and give them their Christmas meals. And the king is the same. He just does it at a higher level. But not everyone can come to court because of that reason of representing his power. So that does mean that the king has a nicely balanced way of showing his own hospitality, but also encouraging others to represent him. So Christmas is an important time for that reason. It's obviously the big religious festival as well. But that doesn't mean that there's a good balance of religious festivities and celebrations with this idea of a large party in the midwinter period, where you're kind of looking towards the new year, I suppose, and the warmer weather and the more relaxed atmosphere that would come in springtime. So it's kind of midwinter celebration of getting through so far. So that does mean that it's important for Henry VIII as his first Christmas to really hit the right note and set his regime's shop window in the right way. So he's using this as an opportunity to show his kingship in the best way possible. So instead of having it at Westminster, he uses Richmond Palace in 1509-10, which is, it's only been rebuilt since 1502. So this is the newest Tudor building in terms of royal residences, and it's very much a sort of Renaissance-style European residence. It's designed to be seen from the river. It's very spectacular in its architecture. It doesn't look like anything else in England at the time. So setting the court at Christmas in this new palace really is showing again that Henry VIII is a king very much in tune with what's happening around Europe. And obviously the ambassadors and visitors would report this. So he wants to make this Christmas celebration a spectacular start to his personal kingship. And for that reason, he invests a lot of time and money in making it a success.
Now, Sean, I don't know about you, but I had some people over Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and I was kind of exhausted after 2 days of celebrations. But the Christmas in Tudor times, it wasn't just a 1 or 2 day affair. Can you talk us through the course of events between Christmas and Twelfth Night?
Yes, it's a prolonged period of celebrations and entertainments. It costs an awful lot of money. Well, it certainly did for Henry VIII. I mean, preparations began in October, November, when the king would start ordering the gifts he was going to give out to people. He always gave out pieces of goldsmith's work, so gilt cups and plates and salt cellars, and he would order these from London goldsmiths in November. And in 1509-10, he spent almost £500 on this kind of gift to be given out. And we know that lots of people prepared for their visit to court very well in the same kind of way. So they'd buy new clothes for themselves, buy new clothes for their servants. They'd invest money to be given as rewards for the king's household officers and servants. So people knew they had to present themselves well at court. They knew they had to be prepared for possibly 10 days, 2 weeks of quite intensive activity, because it's not only the celebrations and the observance of things, but it's also a political and social environment where people are putting themselves on display to catch the king's eye. A lot of business would be concluded. People would go with documents to be signed and sealed and checked. They'd make advantage of having the king's counsellors and high-ranking courtiers around. So it becomes a very important time when not just the celebrations could be accomplished, but lots of other activities to do with how the regime functioned and ticked over. It's a concentration of people and power in the same place. So it becomes very important as a way of distilling what the mechanisms of the regime would be and how the king's power would be worked out between the people who represented him. So people knew they were in for a kind of intensive period of lots of church going at the start, lots of feasting, lots of formal events such as singing and dining in very, very structured ways. So in a kind of hierarchy and rank that their status demanded, so they'd be seated in particular ways and served in particular ways. So they had to be aware of these social etiquettes as well as the actual more nebulous and political aspects of this. So people had to know how to behave themselves. They had to know how to appear. The king would obviously be watching and listening for any signs of disloyalty or any rumours and gossip that he could hear. He'd have people listening out. And we know from the lists of royal servants who were paid, certainly right at the end of Henry VII's reign, he ordered new clothes for the chamber staff. And there's 94 people working in the king's chamber alone at the end of Henry VII's reign in 1508-9. And Henry VIII would have inherited this number of servants. And from Henry VII's funeral list as well, we can see who was actually on duty right at the very end of the reign of Henry VII, the start of Henry VIII. So we're talking about a sort of a group of 3 or 4, maybe even 500 people around the king, just as his servants and officers, as well as all of the guests arriving with their own servants. So this is a massive boost to the number of people around the court and the interactions they could all have. It doesn't mean it's a very interesting and sensitive time anyway, but for the first Christmas of a new king, it's really important to find out what the tone of the country is, how people are talking about how the king is accepted around the country, what kind of reputation he has already, what expectations people have for his rule. So for Henry, it's a real immediate way of really seeing how his accession has been reacted to around the country. And for that reason, he's made this the most lavish party he possibly can in 1509-10.
Wonderful insights. Yeah, things that you don't. So it was so much more than just obviously, you know, partying and having fun and the religious aspect. But yeah, that's really interesting. Now, you mentioned that Henry spent £500 buying these gifts for people. Today, you know, many of us exchange gifts on Christmas Day. However, the Tudors had a different tradition. They generally exchanged their gifts on New Year's Day. Now, this was serious business at the Tudor court and it had great political significance. So why was gift giving, can you go into that a little bit more? Why was it such a valuable tool in building loyalty and service?
Yes, it's really important in recognising loyalty and service just from the exchange of presents, because obviously if the king is giving out quite expensive pieces of gilt, gold and silver, obviously people are giving him gifts as well. So it's an exercise in representing power and actually reminding people that they are favoured and should therefore be loyal in return. There's a kind of, again, a hierarchy about who is given what. So as the king is giving out the same types of things, we can see from the lists of what he's buying from London goldsmiths and what he actually gives out, because I think the chamber staff keep records of who's been given what. It's a description really of the type of object. So it would be a salt cellar or a cup, or a psalter, or some sort of gilt tablet, almost like some say blocks of gold. And these are all recorded by their troy weight in ounces and quarters of ounces. So the more elevated your social status or the closeness of you to the king, the likelihood would be that you'd get a heavier or larger or more elaborate gold object. So that is obviously in itself a valuable item, and we have some of these objects surviving in collections like the Victoria and Albert Museum and the British Museum. So we can see from things like the Howard Standing Cup at the V&A that these things were beautiful and would represent power. So to have one of these given by the king was an immediate way of being acknowledged as a powerful person, a person that the king favours. So that in itself is great, because it shows that you're connected to the king and you can demonstrate that to your own people when they see that on your cupboard in your chamber. And the fact that some of these lists show omissions, so in 1532, for example, the New Year's gifts given by the king has a blank for the queen. So Catherine of Aragon gets nothing that year. And because it's in rank order, so Henry's sister Mary is the French queen, and she gets a nice pair of gilt pots. And then the princess, so Princess Mary, gets more gilt pots and some bowls and a sort of ladle. And then you get a list of bishops, then it's all of the secular lords. So it's very much a formal kind of arrangement, which is demonstrating the king's sort of balance of interests, who he favours, who he wants to promote and reward and encourage. And the converse of that is later on, you get lists of things given by the king. So people giving gifts to Henry, a lot of this is what the wives of the nobles and courtiers have done. So there's lots of embroidery work. It's called stool work because it's been done on the embroidery stools, probably taking several months. So this is embroidering shirt collars or shirts or hats with gold and silver embroidery. And you get quite detailed lists of the items and their quality, I suppose. So a lot of people have spent a lot of time preparing these things and really trying to understand what the king's interests are. So there's an awful lot of greyhound dog collars given. People spend a lot of time thinking about how what they give is going to impress Henry. So in one year, the Countess of Westmoreland actually gives him a pair of greyhounds, right. Not just the actual collars, but a pair of dogs are given. And I think Lady Scroope gives him two large cheeses at one stage. So there's people thinking, well, this is how I'm going to impress Henry or make my gift memorable. I think a lot of it is within the boundaries of what's expected and normal. So he gets occasionally gilt cups or a nice sword, or sometimes I think his sister gives him a writing desk one year. So it's either to encourage him or to give him something which is memorable and makes them stand out, but within a kind of acceptable range of things which either show a lot of personal investment and time and thought, or perhaps have a value. And in the records that the chamber prepare of the gifts received, you can see what Henry does with these things. So he gives a lot of things to Henry Norris, the groom of the stool, who's a very close personal servant, and he'll take them off to the chamber itself. Henry seems to keep all of the cash and the gold himself. He'll send other things off to the wardrobe, which are sort of large objects or things which are for his stable or for his greyhounds. The master of the hounds is given a lot of custody of a lot of these dog related things. So it's a lot of hunting stuff, a lot of things about his personal clothing, cambric shirts, things which are very fine and expensive and would have been quite an investment for the courtiers to prepare or to purchase. So they're thinking maybe for 6 months or more about what they're going to give the king, because they know this is an important time to make an impression, certainly not to hit the wrong note, but at least to make the right impression that they're right in there with the pack and they're not standing out for the wrong reasons. So it's key really for showing how disposed you are towards the king and therefore how well the king is going to be disposed to you. And that's part of that power politics relationship, where, you know, the king relies on these people to represent his power. He wants them to be confident that he's a generous and good lord to them, and also that they're aware that they owe him loyalty and service, and as well as turning up to do things like sit on commissions or be leading juries and inquests. Actually, giving the king a gift is just a very simple way of showing that they're still loyal and determined to impress him. And this is what makes the country work, basically. It's a kind of snapshot of how this power politics works between the king and his courtiers, and how they're meant to project that power and take that power into the country and rule those regions on behalf of Henry. So it's a kind of mini version of what's played out across the year in terms of these personal relationships and how they affect the way the country works and the mood of the people in the country.
And so would the gifts have been presented in a public arena where everyone can sort of see and compare, or look what this person gave, or was it more on an individual sort of basis?
I think it's probably fairly public in that a lot of these things were done in a state, so there'd be formal days, formal gift-giving sessions, and obviously there'd be lots of servants around to see these things and to carry them away. But it would have been slightly unusual, I suppose, to do it in a full court where everyone was kind of filing through in full view of everybody else and demonstrating how they maybe hadn't been able to bring such an impressive gift together. I think this is quite a personal thing, because they're obviously spending time and energy in creating something personal for the king, especially as it's something bought and then finished off by hand, or certainly in terms of the embroidery and the craftsmanship. It's obviously embellished with heraldic badges and the king's personal mottos, that kind of thing. So it's more of a personal activity in the sense of giving something they feel the king wants. But obviously Henry then makes a list of who's given what, so he will know and his close courtiers will know either the value or the the message behind what's been given. Because I think there's a lot of symbolism, and perhaps as the reign moves on, there's clearly a lot of personality behind some of these gifts. And we can see the way Catherine of Aragon is cut out the picture in 1532, that there's clearly a very sort of pointed political and personal aspect to all this, which is reflected in what's given to the king. So I think it would be unusual to do it as an embarrassing sort of full court event, but nevertheless people would know quite quickly what had been given, and obviously those courtiers would talk amongst themselves as well. So the public aspect of it would be more about the public ceremonies and the feasting and dining. This might have been more, slightly more private, but clearly with so many people being around, it couldn't all be done across the whole Christmas period. It had to be done on New Year's Day, perhaps it's some very designated couple of hours, maybe, because the king's obviously getting ready for quite a large party on New Year's Day. Yes. Not as large as Twelfth Night, but you can see from the records of what's paid that, you know, it's one of those key days where payments are made for performances in the hall. So it's one of those days where there is a feast or some sort of public entertainment for the courtiers. So it's an important day for that part of the celebrations where the king will obviously be wearing something which might demonstrate his favoritism, but he's been given so much that he can't possibly, you know, yeah, use it or wear it all in one go. So it's kind of storing up the kind of goodwill, I suppose. You wouldn't want to embarrass somebody unless he really felt the need to. So it's I think there's so much being given to him and being given out that this would obviously take a long time if it was done in a formal ceremony. So it might have been more of a private thing.
Okay, and you've mentioned some of those records that help us understand some of these ceremonies and events that took place. Can you delve into that a little bit deeper? What other records help us understand the ceremonies, the events, the entertainments during this time of year?
Well, a lot of this comes from the payments, and we talked last time about the Chamber Books Project and the records of the treasurer of the chamber, who's really originally was a sort of private accountant of the king's personal rooms and personal spending, but Henry VII had picked up on what Edward IV had done and Richard III and turned the chamber into more of an organ of state, dealing with lots of the high-level money transfers. So for early Henry VIII's reign, this is still continuing, but it's great for us because we've got the formal books of payments, but also a lot of the scrappy accounts and notes and receipts that John Heron, the treasurer of the chamber, kept. So although the formal books tell you in quite summary detail what the spending was, we know from a lot of the preparation documents beneath that, which have survived in loose files, exactly what is being purchased, how it's being spent, what kind of offerings and payments are being made across this period. So we can build up quite a good picture of how the money is paying for all of this. As I said earlier, from October, November onwards, we know that Henry asks the Exchequer to supply another £7,000 to the household, basically to pay for Christmas. Which, wow, is heading £4 to £5 million in today's money. So that's quite a party he's putting together. So from November, he's preparing, ordering food, preparing new uniforms and new equipment, replacing a lot of the broken dishes and candlesticks and all of this. So you can see in that kind of detail how the court is sprucing itself up, really, in terms of its spaces, ready for this great big party. So from Christmas Day, from certainly Tuesday the 25th of December 1509, the chamber records show lots of the offerings in church to the children of the chapel singing Gloria in Excelsis, the men of the chapel singing as well. A lot of that week is spent in church, so each day is a religious feast itself. So you've got Christmas Day, then St. Stephen's Day, St. John's Day, Childermass Day on the 28th of December, and then St. Thomas's Day on the 29th. Henry's in church for a couple of hours each day on all of these days. And then you also have Christmas as a quarter day, so a lot of the staff are getting their quarterly wages at Christmas as well. So it's another reason to think of this as a great big spending spree for everybody. Suddenly, a lot of the officials and servants have their purses filled and they're getting extra rewards for their service. Obviously, not everybody can be involved in the party. A lot of people are still on duty, but they're given rewards for missing out almost. So it's an interesting balance of paying for things that need to be bought and put into the public space for the court to enjoy. A lot of wages and a lot of gifts behind the scenes to make the whole thing run smoothly. It's this interesting balance of how you're observing the church rituals and celebrations. You've got the heralds organising a lot of the formal festivities, so making sure the precedence and etiquette is observed, and they always get a gift of 100 shillings for their efforts in doing this. The children and men of the chapel, certainly early on in this period of celebration, are sort of leading the way, sort of celebrating the religious dimension of this, and that happens in that first week after Christmas. But when you get to New Year, things sort of change more towards a social event rather than a religious event. From the 30th of December, you start to get records of musicians playing in the hall, getting their rewards, the king's actors, who've all got great names like Bartram Barnard and Marquis Loredan, and the minstrels called Bonnie Tomps and Petit Jean Coquerin and Balthazar. They're all getting their rewards as well. So I think they're all very busy. Certainly there's a Christmas feast on Christmas Day, but obviously as you head towards New Year, there's more of this entertainment level coming in. And the Queen has her minstrels, and there's clearly evidence of minstrels playing in the gallery, but also minstrels walking among the tables. So you can begin to put together some of a vision of what would have been going on. You can see from the other records of the way the payments break down for the supply side of the household. So the pantry and the napery and the departments that, I suppose, made the meals run smoothly. You can see how they're being supplied with new equipment and how the food is brought in. Obviously, we don't have the details here of what's prepared, but elsewhere there are details of the diets and how the range of food is purchased. And we can see how that turns into these magnificent meals with their subtleties and extravagant sort of preparations. So the records are great for telling you how the money was spent and when it was spent, so therefore you can pick up a pattern of how the mood changes from observance to celebration. And then as you head towards Twelfth Night, it really just become more of a wild party with the Lord of Misrule being paid for his time. Much more about, say, the Yeoman of the Guard, as people get a little bit out of control, there's more emphasis on securing the building, I suppose. You even get more about the disguisings and the actual dancing side of it also. Richard Gibson is the master of the revels, and his accounts survive from right at the start of Henry VIII's reign. So we've got the famous, what's called a gladness, which was a surprise for the Queen. After they'd finished at Richmond, they went back to Westminster, and on the 18th of January, Henry and 12 of his friends sort of leapt into her chamber disguised as Robin Hood, completely dressed in green with green faces. And we can see who was with Henry. It's the people like the Earl of Essex and Lord Hastings, Lord Fitzwalter, Sir Edward Howard, the two Parr brothers, the two Guildford brothers. So Henry's friends are already visible. And it's interesting that it's a mixture of the sons of the old nobles from Henry VII's reign and some of these kind of gentry dynasties that had already formed up around the Tudors. So Henry's spending time with them because they're, again, going to be his representatives, the kind of people he needs to rely on to rustle up some soldiers when he decides to invade France, or to pay his taxes, or to ensure that his money keeps coming in. As well as these very personal friends who seem to just have power at court, these are the men who work in the country. So Gibson's accounts are very interesting for this social side of the court, for this entertainment side, and you've got all of the expensive clothes and cloths he holds in his own storerooms almost, and he's always moaning about how the courtiers get their expensive disguise outfits made from cloth of gold and tissue silver and these fine velvets and things. He's really worried that they just walk away with these clothes that are worth pounds, and he never sees them again, almost like worn once and then taken away. So he's constantly asking the king to ensure that his friends send the costumes back once they'd worn them, so he can have them remade. So you get a sense from this of how it all fits together. And obviously there's then reports from observers like the ambassadors and letters from people who were at court who tell you as eyewitnesses what was going on. So we can put together quite a good picture of how, certainly in the hall, this is all happening in the hall at Richmond, or later on at Eltham, or at Greenwich, or at Westminster. And it's following a pattern that's been established back into the medieval period, really. This idea of building up to Christmas, rewarding the people who can't be there because they're working in the country. So their servants bring the gifts they're going to give to the king. And you'll see a big list of those servants given rewards because their masters couldn't be there. But nevertheless, they've sent a gift in. So you can see who wasn't at court, and then obviously deducting who was there from who's not been given a reward for not being there. So you can see how that changes over time, who's being required to come, maybe who's being expected to stay. And like, if you're Percy or a Stanley or a Howard, you're expected to be out in your region, not necessarily coming to court for 2 weeks, because that's quite a long time to be out of the loop of what's happening around the country. And Henry needs to know what the mood, like I said earlier, of the country is. So the records themselves, as you piece all these bits together, really do give you quite a nice snapshot of how things work at the centre, but also how this is all linked to the regions and how it's an important period, really, for seeing how the dynamism of the whole structure of the king's power is working. And Henry's very much aware of this. You know, he's spent a lot of money in preparing this party and in ensuring that it's working in all these different ways. So he can really get his finger on the pulse very early in his reign and just get a sense of how well he can rely on these people and take that relationship forward as he builds his kingship.
Sounds like just an amazing period of time. What I'd give to be a fly on the wall and see that firsthand. Mm. So you, in terms of cost of this amazing first Christmas of Henry's, you mentioned £7,000 at one point there. So I'm thinking it's in excess of that. Is that right?
Yes. I think at the end of the whole period, sort of by mid-January, when all of the bills are coming in, you find that it's crept up a bit. And I think the overall cost at the end was about £11,000. Because the actual records, you've got to take out the final costs for Henry VII's funeral, which is about £20,000. But in that final quarter of 1509, Henry spends about £35,000 in 3 months, taking out the £20,000, this extra £7,000, which Parliament allows the king about £14,000 a year for his household expenses. But Henry asks for another £7,000 in that first period, and he spends it all. So he's spent about £11,000 on things to do with the court in that final quarter of 1509. And most of that probably goes on this party and how it's a pivotal moment in kind of drawing the curtains back on the old regime and showing this brilliant, magnificent new court at work. So Henry's invested heavily. He has this large supply of cash from his father's regime, and he's spending it straight away. Obviously, he's thinking of war already as a way of cementing his glory, although Wolsey is beginning to pull the strings a little bit. He's clearly part of the pack still. It's very much this old guard of courtiers still running the show, and Wolsey hasn't quite got to the preeminent position he will in sort of 4 or 5 years' time. So Henry is still finding his way and still trying to negotiate and navigate around the interests. A lot of these vested interests in the old people, who would be quite old as well, because some of these guys like Lovell and Richard Fox, they live into the 1520s and they're still around the king as his senior advisors. Obviously, Henry's not spending social time with them in the same way he would be with people who are, you know, 18 to 20, people like Charles Brandon, who he's kind of come to know very well, and these jousting friends of his from when he was 14, 15, 16. So there's a dynamic going on here, and the king is using this as an opportunity to spend heavy, to make this impression as glorious as he can do, and really give himself every opportunity to invite everyone's collaboration as he takes his power forwards. You know, he really wants to show what he can do and how this is a new step for the crown in this second Tudor reign. As the son of his father, he's going to be a king in a very different way, because he doesn't have to worry so much about the threats and the pretenders. The kind of way he acceded to the throne is got rid of that threat. He's got his hands on Edmund de la Poole now. He can really look to build those alliances and use Europe as a platform to sort of bring England to the high table of politics, and he's very keen to do that. And so demonstrating the power and the magnificence of his kingship by spending all this money and really putting a lot of investment into dazzling people as soon as he can. And it means this Christmas is really important, because it sets that scene, it creates that impression, and it really sets the tone for what Henry wants to do later.
Fascinating. And just to put it into perspective for anyone listening, £11,000 and those sorts of amounts might not sound like so much today, but we're talking millions and millions and millions of pounds in today's money.
Yeah, definitely. So it's a staggering amount, really. Obviously, that pays for a lot of what else is going on. But to be honest, not a lot else is going on at this time.
That's right.
This is really a focus for Henry. And then he can take what he can from this period and set a lot of policies running from the basis of it. So it's important to for himself to see with his own eyes, or at least to hear from reports out in the country, you know, how his accession is being received and how he's ready to really strike a new note for his kingship.
Absolutely. Intriguing details. Thank you so much for sharing. Now, Sean, the last time we chatted, you left us with some great food for thought as your Tudor takeaway. You reminded us of something that I think sometimes we take for granted or we forget a little, and that's that what we see in the records and the archives today was actually created by, you know, real living, breathing people. And you noted that the Tudor landscape is still there, just waiting for us to find it or to be found, which I find really exciting. But since this is a brand new episode, I'm going to ask you for another Tudor takeaway for our listeners. So do you have something that our listeners might be able to check out after the episode, whether it be a book, a film, a website, anything at all?
I think I'd like people to have a go at trying to read the documents. I mean, there's quite a lot more that's now available, either to get you images of original documents and to help you read them as well. I think people obviously see that as a real challenge, but actually a lot of these things in this period are in English, and a lot of it is fairly simple because especially the financial records are minimal text and a lot of numbers, and they're quite easy to navigate once you pick up some words. And when we're trying to train people to read this stuff, a lot of people come to the table with no knowledge at all, and in 5 minutes they're picking out letters and words. So I think if you really want to get to the source of information about the late 15th, 16th century, you can do this yourself in a very short amount of time. There's a few websites which have just images and no search engine. So the Anglo-American Legal Tradition website, for example, at the University of Houston, has a lot of the legal and financial records from Henry VIII's reign already available as digital images. You need to follow the referencing, say, from the National Archives catalogue to find things of interest. But a lot of the accounts or the indictments for legal offences are there. And you can pick up some of these materials in English and have a go. I think if you really want to start to form your own ideas about what's going on, using published books as a basis, but obviously there's nothing like getting to see the original documents and forming your own opinions from what you can read, because your view of things is as valid as everybody else's once you can actually handle the original sources and see what was written by those people in the past, rather than relying on someone else's interpretation of it. Obviously, some of that has to be taken with a pinch of salt, because the whole process of creating a document is actually part of that political environment it was created in. So you can get used to how you read these things with one eye on who's writing it and what they're writing it for. But nevertheless, this is the raw materials that historians have to use to create those opinions that end up in books. But everyone has the right and the ability to get back to that material as well. So I think that's what I'd encourage people to do. Go straight to the horse's mouth and see what you can get from the manuscripts.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice. And I think we all need a little bit of encouragement like that once in a while. So thank you so much. So Sean, thank you again for joining me again here on Talking Tudors. And I'm really looking forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you very much, Natalie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.